numerous people are here for this morning's Dhamma talk. Because we had lots of questions left over from last night, and I hope you don't mind that sometimes a question opens up a very beautiful area of Dhamma. So some of the questions took a little bit of a while, but they had some very good points to them. So I'm going to spend maybe the first half an hour answering some of these questions, and the last half an hour until 9 o'clock with a Dhamma talk. Is that okay for everybody? Okay. So all these questions, I just open them up at random, so they may repeat what was happened before, but I'm not sure. But I do remember that questions were really important because they're relevant to what people want to hear rather than what I think they should hear. Okay, the first question is, when I try to let my mind wander around after a while, I can feel my breath and it seems become darker and darker and silent, but then my mind wandering to other things like monkey. How to handle this situation? Okay, your mind would wander around a bit and then it felt the breath. It's sometimes important just to understand that why does the mind wander around too much? And of course it is because of a lack of kindness, a lack of a good relationship with the breath, sometimes to give the breath some degree of freedom. But if it does wander around a bit, see if you can go with that wandering mind. In other words, it doesn't wander away from you. You follow it wherever it goes. And imagine yourself like a private detective or like a spy. And so your breath goes just round the corner to the left, and then you follow it to the left. It goes to the right, and you follow it to the right. It goes into the room, you follow it into the room. You don't tell it where it should be going. You just watch it wherever it goes. And that was the meaning of that meditation of the Emperor's Three Questions. Now the most important time. Whatever's in front of you is the most important thing in the whole world. Whatever's happening now, whatever the mind is up to, that is the most important. And you care for it. So that means wherever you are, that's where your mindfulness is, that's where your mind is. So it doesn't wander. If you want the breath to be the center of your attention, if you want to get nimittas, if you think meditation should all be about getting jhanas, then you're right. But it's how you get there is most important. So that wherever you are, that's where your mindfulness is. So you can, you catch yourself, you train yourself. It's not wandering mind, it's just, now, where am I right now? This is the most important thing in the whole world, and you're here in this moment. So how can the mind wander off? In fact, what's happening here is, it's not the mind is wandering off, but you're not giving this moment attention. So the mind is doing something, and you're just... you want to be somewhere else. So even if you're fantasizing, you're dreaming, you're dull, just want to be here. When you're happy to be here, this freedom, this also is a build-up of energy starts to occur and you become more and more awake. So to deal with the wandering mind doesn't mean just more effort. It means more wisdom, more understanding. Why does the mind wander off? So don't try and control it, understand it. Ajahn, I want to improve my meditation practice. Oh, please don't. Your meditation practice is good enough. Please stop improving. As soon as you want to improve, there's a lack of respect to where you already are. It's a minor form, a fine form of ill will. Be happy where you are and then see what happens. Please tell me what I should do when I am close to getting to one of those rare moments of stillness and the person behind me is yawning, sighing. I know we can all be inconsiderate at times, but is there a protocol for group meditation? The protocol for group meditation is when somebody is snoring, you give them kindness. There's a story I haven't told yet of the monk who asked me if his brother could come and stay from Europe. And I said, well, of course, you know, your family can come and stay, but there's a retreat on at Jhana Grove, there's no space there. And Bodhinyana Monastery is full, there's people taking up every square inch of the place. And the inside it's the monks and lay people, on the outside it's the kangaroos and the ants and the flies. And but then he said, well, he's my brother, we grew up together, now we can share the room together. And I said, oh, well, okay, but, you know, if you don't mind. He said, of course I don't mind. It's only small rooms where the monks live. And so, but I said, look at your age. I'm sure that either your brother or you, one of you will start snoring. And if one of you starts snoring, the other one will be awake for the rest of the night. And this monk said, I've got that all planned, that I'm going to go to sleep first. So that means his brother, he's not very compassionate. So his brother can't go to sleep, so his brother can't snore and wake him up. So that was his plan. But of course, it never works that way. His brother went to sleep straight away. And as soon as he started going to sleep, he started snoring really loudly. And the monk thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to be awake all night. Because in a small room, his brother was snoring really loudly. And so that's when he started contemplating what Ajahn Chah would say, what I reminded him too. It's not the noise disturbs you, it's you who disturb the noise. And there he was, in this room, with it almost reverberating with his brother's elephant snoring. And just after a little while, he said, well, look, I can't stop him snoring, but maybe I can investigate the don't disturb the noise. So how can I disturb the noise? And so he started using his powers of perception to imagine, to perceive that brother snoring like an avant-garde cutting-edge musical symphony where everything was dissonant, nothing actually, no chords, no sort of keys, that every note was totally different than the ones before him. And it was like a music without any form or without any structure. And it was, that was his brother's you call it like wind instruments, like a trumpet solo. And he imagined it like something which was very musical. And being quite a refined young monk, you know, who had studied some music somewhere, he started perceiving his brother snoring in a totally different way, as having just amazing sort of refined, almost defying melody, but still was a melody in there. And that was the last thing he remembered when he woke up in the morning. He had a lovely night's sleep. Instead of looking at the negative side of his brother snoring, he started to imagine it as something beautiful and wonderful. He said, that's what we mean by not disturbing the noise. Which meant that afterwards he was fine, had a good night's sleep, and he valued that experience and told me about it, and I've shared it with other people. So if somebody is making a noise behind you in a group meditation, wonderful. At least they're here doing some meditation. And what, so change one's attitude, you're kind to it. And then it's just, it's not a disturbance anymore. In one of these retreats which I taught in Sydney, there was one gentleman who was making such a noise when he was meditating that on the questions I got all these complaints the very first night. Can you please tell everybody, they didn't mean everybody, they meant this gentleman, to please, please breathe quietly when you're meditating. This fellow's going, ah, ah. And then, of course, I made the announcement that that gentleman was dying of sinus cancer. His doctors had given up any hope, all treatments were not effective, and he'd just come to the retreat to give this big tumour in his sinuses a chance to, who knows, maybe meditation could help him. And as soon as I told people the reason why this gentleman was breathing loudly, there were no more complaints. They looked at that noise as something which was, oh, isn't it wonderful that he's trying to do something, trying to maybe help, you know, his cancer, and had so much compassion for this gentleman, and there was no more complaints about him. And of course, on that story, it had a beautiful ending. The beautiful ending was that at the end of the retreat, you know, he told me he heard a popping sound, and he could breathe for 1 minute, and then the tumor closed up again. And I thought that that was, you know, too late for him. He should have done his meditation earlier. But nevertheless, he continued on, because about 6 months later, in another venue in Sydney, this man came up to me and said, "Do you remember me?" And of course, it was that gentleman. And look, no one in the world could connect the gentleman standing before me 6 months afterwards and just the skin and bones, wasted man who was dying of a sinus tumor. You know, he carried on meditating, and it would just vanished. And he said, he came to see me, "Thank you so much." And I couldn't recognize him. He looked much, so much healthier. If you've seen somebody in the last stages of cancer, and then you see them sort of 6 months later when the tumor's, you know, gone, they're in remission, and they put on weight, they look sort of more bright, their skin is a much better color, and everything was, you know, how do you expect me to remember you? You look totally different. Yes, yeah, so he got over that cancer, and he said a beautiful thing: whatever life is left to me in this incarnation, I'm going to use it to teach the meditation like you taught me, to maybe help others. Very beautiful little comment there. So when you find out why people are making noise, then give them kindness. It's the best they can do. So give them a break and say, "It's well wonderful. It may be group meditation time, you're making sort of a noise, but at least you're here. So thank you." And for those people who are here, if you make a noise, then do try to make less noise. There's little things like, you know, the plastic bags and stuff, which always rustle, you know, when you bring them in. So try to be quiet, if you possibly can. And that's great for your mindfulness and kindness to others, but there will always, always be noise somewhere. So be kind to the noise. "Ajahn Brahm, I have finally understood and experienced the first two stages in your book, The Basic Method of Meditation. More importantly, could you please organize a singles event at Dhammaloka? It is hard to meet single Buddhists. I would like to try partner suffering. Tinder is no good. Thank you kindly from a single Buddhist." My role in life is to lessen suffering. Now, if you want to do something like that, if you want to try partner suffering, then go out to the stupa, put your hand inside, and if you can touch the Buddha, then maybe you can find true love. Anyway, it is true that we have this group, we call it the Kalyanamitta group. It was supposed to be our youth group. It started off, I think, from 15 to 25-year-olds or something. And then, because people are just so hungry for any Dhamma, you get all sorts of people on a Saturday night coming along, you know, to listen. But it was really meant to be a youth group. And, of course, that was a place where many of these young people, they met, and, of course, they were Buddhists together, and they paired off and got married. So that's why we lost a lot of our members. But it is true that, you know, if you are going to share a life together, it's wonderful you share a life with people who like think alike and, you know, have the same good motivations and kindness towards one another. So that's why we do have these little groups. So it is really should be the the Kalyanamitta group on a Saturday evening, singles events. So not everyone's going to become a monk or a nun. And somebody, people say, what would happen if everyone became a monk or a nun? I'd be in big trouble. There'd be no one to cook or feed me. So anyway, Ajahn Brahm, as a beginner, what is your recommended to do meditation? Once a day or once a week is good enough. When is the best time to meditate?
Now.
When is the worst time to meditate?
Later,
yes. So in other words, when you have the opportunity, just take it to do some meditation. And meditation doesn't need to be sitting on the floor cross-legged. That meditation could just be learning just how to go out into your garden and maybe just with a cup, just, you know, it looks like you're doing something, and just sit out there and again watch the trees grow. Don't take your laptop or your mobile phone or whatever. Don't go planning what you're going to do. Just sit out there and learn the art of doing nothing, of, you know, watching the trees grow. Just being there with no destination, nothing to do. You're not trying to achieve anything or get anywhere. You're just sitting just for the sake of doing nothing. In a garden or in a balcony of an apartment. But make sure you're not doing anything. And when people ask you, what are you doing? So that's a simple question. I'm just being. I'm not doing. I'm just here. I'm not going anywhere. I'm not trying to improve myself or learn anything. Spent my whole life learning stuff and then forgetting it. What a waste of time that was. All the things which you learnt in life, all the quantum mechanics and astrophysics of the galaxy, you've forgotten all of that now. Was it really worthwhile? How much are you going to take with you when you die? So instead, take peace and kindness. Kindness for yourself. Give yourself a moment of peace. And you realize how foolishly you've scurried around. That's in this little poem at the beginning of my opening the door of your heart. It says you have to give yourself peace. You're not entitled to it. It's not given to you. You have to take it. I hereby give myself a free half hour. Free means I don't have to do anything. I'm not going to meditate. I'm not going to prepare a talk. I'm not going to read anything. I'm not going to get on the internet. I'm just going to do absolutely nothing. So grant yourself those moments. And that is how you start your meditation practice. Listening to one of your sutta classes, I heard you mention that consciousness and consciousness and emerge in a part and then go on to take, can emerge in something and then go on to take an animal existence. At a later time, if that being reflected its past lives, what would he see before it was a tree? Oh, a cow can emerge in a plant and then go on to take an animal existence. At a later time, that being reflected its past life, what would it see before it was a tree? Could it have been an animal before that? If so, an animal before a tree. Well, that's... Please excuse me, I think someone's thinking too much. But nevertheless, this was when people asked about the origin of consciousness or the origin of beings. And it's only one sutta where the Buddha said, yeah, you can actually imagine that there is a very rudimentary form of consciousness, even in plants. But it hasn't got any self-awareness, and that can actually grow and evolve. It's not the evolution of the forms in which consciousness can take root, but it's actually evolution of consciousness itself, as like a separate stream, which goes into this being or that being, and at birth, at origination, and sort of takes life in that. And it's a wonderful other way of looking at evolution, the evolution of consciousness, of minds, rather than the evolution of the forms in which minds take a root. The evolution of the driver, if you like, of a car, rather than the evolution of the vehicle in which they sit and turn the driving wheel. So that's, you know, one thing which the Buddha said, which was an interesting point. But this is over long periods of time. And of course, people said, well, this universe has only been here for, oh, I think the last time I looked, 17,000 million years since the Big Bang. But this is not the first universe. There's always been many universes. And even just the astrophysicists agree upon that. The Big Bang was not the beginning of this universe cycle. It was actually one of those mates of mine, Bernard Carr. He was also a close researcher with Stephen Hawking. And one of his research projects was not black holes, but white holes. In other words, that proving that black holes, they do decay. It's not the end point. And because they can decay, the same with Big Bangs, which is black holes, you know, turn backwards in time. It was that this life existence before the black hole, or before the Big Bang. So that even one of the other movies which I saw was that the bio picture of Stephen Hawking. And I did that because mate Bernard Carr was supposed to be featured in that. He didn't actually appear, but an actor played the part. And there, I just really noticed that when I checked it with Bernard, and it's correct that Stephen Hawking was saying, he imagines a universe with no boundaries, not in time or in space. So not a beginning of time, not an end of time. Goes round and round and round and round and round. And the explanation of that, Ajahn Brahmstal, is 300-400 years ago, people understood this world was flat. It's obvious it's flat. So people really thought, if you get in a boat, which was the most advanced form of long-distance travel, that you'd eventually come to the edge of the world and fall off. And of course, we know that intrepid sailors went around the world. They kept on going in one direction and they came back to where they started from again. The world is a sphere. Limited area, but it's got no edges to it. No boundaries. We all know it's got a limited area because, you know, we are struggling to find enough water, enough clean air, enough food on this limited area planet. And you wonder how much longer can we keep on expanding. So anyway, it's a limited area, but without any edges. And that's the same with space. And people used to imagine, like I used to imagine, if you go far enough in a spacecraft, would you actually come to the edge of the universe? So we can't go any further? Or is the universe infinite? And there was, I remember seeing this even in the sixth form, it was a very beautiful, simple, but very compelling little theory called the Obler's Paradox, who says the universe cannot be infinite. Otherwise, that the base it would burn up. It was a beautiful little proof. But anyway, we all know now that the universe isn't infinite. It's got a certain size. It's got a volume. It keeps on expanding, but it's at the moment it's you can actually pretty much tell how much space there is in this universe in which we are now sitting. So if it's a certain volume but it's got no edges to it, then what's going on? And I still recall at university just when the lecturer came in and just got a big football, a round football, and he said, just like the earth, it's got no boundaries but limited area, so does space have limited volume but no edges, because the space is curved. So what that means, whichever way you go, if you go from jhana growth, that direction or that direction, after you've done one complete circle of the universe, you'll come right back here. So jhana growth is the centre of the universe. As is any other place you happen to be. So even space is curved. It's got no edges, no boundaries. You go far enough, you don't come to the end of the universe. And of course, the next beautiful thing is time. Years from now, if we survive, civilizations will say, oh, you people, you were flat timers, just as like people could only believe in a flat earth. You believed in flat time. If you go far enough into the past, you come to the origin, the birth, the start of the universe. And if you go a bit further, you fall off that edge. You go further into the future and you'll come to the end of time, like a boundary, a barrier, and fall off that. And of course that makes no logical sense at all. Instead, imagine like time curved, with no beginning, with no end. Just like planet Earth, limited space, but no beginning, no end, no boundaries. Curved time. And that to me is so obvious and so beautiful. Everything in this world goes round and round. Dear Ajahn, what is the most difficult aspect for most monastics? Oh, it's usually trying to answer the question of what is the most difficult aspect for most monastics. Most difficult? We don't... Now that's a sort of question which just doesn't relate. We don't think of the most difficult aspect of, you know, from the past to the future, what was my most difficult aspect so far. We don't compare. So a lot of time as a monastic, you let go of the past. And so when you first asked that question, you had to think and go back through all of the database of my past, most of which has been deleted. And for the difficult, you don't even look upon it as difficult or easy. You know the old story, the good, bad, who knows story? I'm not going to tell that now because that takes a bit of a while. But, you know, sometimes what you thought was bad and difficult was actually the best. You know, when you tread in the dog poo, that's your fertilizer. So difficult? No, it's just challenging maybe, but yeah, we just keep going forward and just keep doing it. The whole idea of calling it difficult just doesn't really apply. Often people say, because you study Dhamma, Buddha and chanting, have a good something, which is a good energy. Often people say, I don't know who says this, because you study Dhamma, Buddha on chanting, you have good energy, which a demon and ghost want, so they come to take energy from you. Is it true? Or is it my negative thoughts attracting the demon? Now, nobody takes me what you don't want to give. So if you don't want to give ghosts any energy, of course, you know, they can come back another time. Or just go to someone else. If any demon wants energy from you on this retreat, you say, no, not for me. Ajahn Brahm lives in cottage number one, or in the teacher's cottage. You don't send them there. Send them to the nuns. They've got lots of energy there. If you're seeking for a donation, you don't seek a donation from a poor person. You give it from like a kind, generous people. We've got lots of spiritual wealth. So he said, look, if you really, demon, if you really want to get some really good energy, you know, just really good donation, just in that cottage at the end over there, you know, the monks, or the cottage at the other end. Now those are really raw. And it's actually in the nun's cottage, even better than my cottage, because there's four of you there. So no, it's because you have good energy, its ghost can't come close to you. And that's many, many anecdotes about that. One of those anecdotes was a Thai lady many years ago, and she had a mum in Thailand, father had passed away, so she invited her mother to come to Australia. And those were the days where, you know, the government was much more, I would say, open and compassionate, and you could ask your parents and grandparents to come to Australia and you look after them. And they look after some of your kids as well. It's a win-win deal for everybody. And anyway, so she brought her mum over, and soon her mother got sick and was in the King Edward Hospital for Women over in Subiaco somewhere. And her mother was really sick, and so she wondered whether that her mother would survive the illness. So she went to a medium, a spirit doctor here in Perth, and apparently the fee was very little, only $20 at that time. It's probably gone up because of inflation and GST and other taxes which spirits have to pay. So anyway, so she gave her a $20 note, and then the spirit medium only wanted to know mother's name, the hospital, the ward and the room number. And then she would leave her body, you know, just go in the astral plane and check out her mother's astral body. And that's how she'll find out if that this was the last illness or whether her mother would recover. So the medium went into a trance for about 20 minutes or about that time, and then she came out of the trance, and without saying anything, gave the $20 back to this nun, Thai girl, and said, "Well, couldn't you find my mum?" She said, "Oh, I found her, okay, but I couldn't get into her room." She said, "Your mother was surrounded by a force field. I've never seen that before. I couldn't get close to her to find out, you know what the future was for her sickness. Who is your mum?" And at that, this Thai girl said, "Oh, she's an 8-precept Buddhist nun. She's been an 8-precept Buddhist nun for a long time. She meditates, she keeps her precepts." At which point, the medium grabbed the $20 back and said, "You wasted my time. You should have told me beforehand who your mum was. People like me cannot get close to people like that." And that was, you know, she told me that story, and that's just true. If you're keeping your precepts, if you're kind, you're generous, you meditate, ghosts and spirits can't get close to you except with your permission. You have power. And the last little story there, that one of my friends, associates here, she was like, you know, a medium, but she visited once, she visited quite often, and I was walking by with one of the monks, and she looked at that monk and said, "That monk's in trouble. He's got a big black cloud over him." I said, "Yeah, you know, he disrobed a couple of days later. He was at sort of the end of his monastic life." She spotted him straight away. But anyway, the one day she came with an indigenous elder to visit Bodhinyana Monastery. And she told me only afterwards that the indigenous elder, sort of as soon as he was coming in the gate, said, "No, I can't go in here. It's too powerful." And so he just sat outside the gate for about the hour while she came to visit. She told me about it afterwards. And I scolded her for that. I said, "Look, you know, that indigenous elder could feel just, you know, the power of that monastery. And all he would need is just an invitation. You should have asked me. He was outside. I just said, or even thought, come in. And he would have been able to come in. He was sensitive enough to the power of the monastery that, oh, I can't get in here." But if you invite them in, it's no problem. So for ghosts and spirits, you have the power, especially if you're doing some meditation, to actually say, you know, come in, it's okay. You know, we can just teach you some Dharma, calm you down. Or, you know, just say, no, it's not the right time, go. Because people who are practicing meditation and stuff like that have way more power than any ghost or spirit. They are literally lower beings. And you're higher beings. So that's why the ghosts just don't have a chance around us. Anyway, in your book says you have no choice to read this book. What do you mean by that? It's proved it because you read that book. What about your will? Like I decide and plan to come to do this retreat. It's not me. Who is it? What makes it happen? It's just all the conditioning, all the thinking, all the brainwashing by monks like me. And it's wonderful. If you had no choice, how can you be responsible? Isn't it wonderful to have one day a week being irresponsible? All the burden of responsibility which people have, that just weighs you down. My responsibility is I'm supposed to be teaching you. Maybe, I don't know, am I? When you're responsible for something, oh, you're worried about it. Imagine, just imagine having a day, or even an hour, even 5 minutes, irresponsible free hour. Once a week, or even once a year or something. That'd be great. So once a year, you're not responsible for anything. You're totally free, with no duties, nothing to perform, nothing you can be judged for. You can just be spontaneous. How would your meditation be? How would your life be? What would you do if you did not try to please anything or get anywhere or improve anything? But just irresponsible hour. And contemplate that, see what you feel. Anyway, I'll do one more question and then I'll do a little talk. How to ensure getting reborn in a realm where there is Sangha who can guide us through the stream entry in the next life? How to ensure getting reborn? First of all, the first thing you need to do is to die first. That's one, okay, take that off first of all. The point is, you know, you're still alive, so don't worry about that until it comes. Cross that bridge when you get to it, as I used to say. And so people are just so worried about the future, they forget that the present moment is where your future is being made. So to ensure getting reborn in a realm where the Sangha can guide us through the stream winning, stop thinking about that. Because if you still keep thinking about it, you're missing this present moment. So practice, be here, and just be kind, be peaceful, be gentle, and that's the best you can possibly do. You can't do better than that, and being in this moment and making this moment as beautiful and perfect as possible. Okay, so I've got through some of them, maybe. But for the Dharma talk here, you can actually, this is the Dharma talk part of today, you do actually see that as you do become more peaceful and calm, you do get so many insights, and insights which are just, you know, goes against what other people keep saying. The things about just being irresponsible. You can't be irresponsible. Being irresponsible is being lazy, being decadent, just being selfish. And you find actually that the times that a person is irresponsible is usually the time of great innovation and rest. I don't know how many times it happens. Oh, I remember they said this, the water cooler. That sometimes in some offices, some corporations, they would prevent people from going to the water cooler because from their desk, walking over to get a glass of water, They'd always get into a conversation with somebody at the water cooler, and I'd be wasting 15, 20 minutes of the company time. And then they found out when they stopped that and just had bottled water at the desk that the innovation and productivity went down. And they noticed that going to the water cooler was actually where they met one another and actually where the great breakthroughs happened. And that also reminds me of the old Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge. They've moved it into a bright new premises. And I just sometimes, it's not because I'm a traditionalist, why did they do that? Because the old building had this, it was alive, it was magic, it had all this history behind it. That's where Rutherford split the atom, and where J.J. Thompson discovered the electron, and where, I forget who the name was now, who discovered quasars and pulsars and lasers were all discovered in this old laboratory, which was a warren of corridors and rooms going all over the place. If ever you imagined a place where there was a mad professor, that would be it. You know, in the end of a corridor, in a room, just, you know, just trying to discover just this weird thing. And who knows, he maybe discovered it, but, you know, it was canned by the MI5 or MI6 or something. But that was all these mad, brilliant people. But when I first went there, and I was taken into the tea rooms. Okay, this was English culture, okay? Tea, morning and afternoon, it's important. But these were no special tea rooms, because all the tables were made out of this plastic formica, and they had felt-tip pens, lots of them, and they replenished whenever they got dry on the tables. Because on those tables were all the greatest theorems and equations were written. Because what would happen, you'd be in your own just trying to figure out, you know, black holes or whatever, or big bangs, and you come across a block, you know, in the equation. You go to the tea time. Everyone had to go to tea time. You know, it was, you know, you had to go there. Compulsory, morning and afternoon. And there you'd see somebody and you'd be writing it down on the table with a cup of tea. And then somebody would come and said, oh, well, maybe, why not try this or try that? And that interaction on the tea rooms of Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge, that was where breakthroughs happened. Amazing breakthroughs which got Nobel Prizes and moved physics to the next generation. Because it was people coming together, just having a cup of tea and a sandwich or a bun. And then when I saw that, I did actually contemplate all those what looked like just, you know, middle-aged women who were serving the tea, whether they all had secret cameras somewhere, whether really in those days KGB operators, because those amazing secrets were written on on those desks. You know, it's breakthroughs in science, intellectual brilliance, but they would just wash it off afterwards. But that was why, that at those times when you were not trying, you were relaxing with a cup of tea and a sort of a sticky bun or something. There, you would actually relax enough to make the breakthroughs. And that's one of the reasons why, with insights, deeper understandings, innovation in business or in science or even in sort of literature, to be able just to relax to the max instead of forcing it. No writer's block, no just being on the edge of a deep discovery, but knowing there's something there, but you can't get that last link. No, this is where you relax and these things, they just come up. And this is one of what Ajahn Chah used to say, that in those forest monasteries, we had to sweep the paths every day. We're always sweeping. And one of the reasons was that there were many dangerous animals in those jungles. It wasn't just the snakes, it was the scorpions. The even worse than the scorpion bites were the centipedes. centipedes over here don't hurt much at all, but in Thailand they're supposed to hurt more than snake bites. But, you know, not as deadly, but they certainly sting like bilio, whatever bilio means. I was going to say sting like hell, but I'm not supposed to say that. But anyway, so that you needed to keep those paths clean. And because that part of Thailand was, the soil was sandy, it's like white sand. So when you swept the path from the leaves, it was like a white ribbon going through the jungle, so you could see your way, and also you could see if there's anything across the path, even at night time. So that we'd sweep those paths often. But then sometimes as soon as you swept the path and it was nice and clean of all leaves, a little breeze would come and a leaf would drop right in the centre of the path which you had just swept. And of course, being perfectionist, you would turn round and sweep that little leaf off. Why? Because as soon as you sweep that leaf off, one behind you would fall. That was the nature of the forest. You can't continually sweep it, so you make it as clean as possible. But when we said that, Ajahn Chah said, yeah, that's true. When a leaf falls from a tree into the natural air of the forest, it gets lost amongst all those other leaves and twigs. It just becomes one of the multitude there. When you've just swept a path and one leaf falls in the middle, it stands out. It's one leaf amongst emptiness. And that leaf, you can see its colour, its shape, the veins on it, you can see everything. Because it's alone, just one leaf has suddenly fallen where there was no others. He said that was his simile for insight. If you've got a very active mind, many thoughts, many ideas, many things appear in it all at once in a tangle of knowledge. Of course, you can't see very much. But if you're perfectly still, you're empty, no thoughts in the mind, then one idea falls and you can see it perfectly. Ah, now I understand what a leaf is. Now I understand what will is. Because it just falls where there hasn't been any will for a long time. The body. It just falls where there hasn't been any body awareness for a long time. You can feel it, you get to know it. Anything else, just like happiness. The meaning of happiness, the truth of what actually is it? It's what everybody searches for. What is it? It's what everybody strives for, but very few people know what it's like and what causes it. But when your mind is so still and peaceful, you've not been searching for happiness, you've not been wanting happiness, you've just been totally at peace, when a little bit of happiness falls, that's what it is. Because it's not confused with so much stuff before and after. We are complicated. It's a difficult world we live in. There's so many things to think about, to do, to find solutions to. There's so much pressing business which is needed to be solved. Of course, we don't have that freedom, that emptiness, to really get these deep insights into the nature of things. Which is one of the reasons why we come on these retreats. To get so peaceful, so still, there's hardly anything dropping in our mind at all. And that's the time. All these great insights happen. Ah, now I know. Because our mind is clear and not busy. To be content, easy, satisfied. What is it? Not busy with duties. Which means not busy with things to do. That's a very difficult call, even for a monk like me. But what I do, making sure when I'm meditating, I'm not an abbot. I'm not a teacher. When I sit down and close my eyes, all of those responsibilities and duties disappear. It's one of the reasons why that for some years, this is just elaborating on that insight. For some years, I was always realized I was basically doing two jobs and a little bit on the side. And the main two jobs would be the abbot of Bodhinyana Monastery and the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society in Western Australia. So on Friday afternoon, I'd leave monastery, go to town for the weekend job, where you were looking after the committees and executive committees and accounts and emails and teaching and making sure all the people in town were okay. Sunday afternoon, evening, you come back here and find out what the monks were up to and helping them and just doing the job which any abbot, senior monk would do anywhere in the world, looking after a big monastery. So I had two jobs to be done. 5 days a week, Bodhinyana Monastery, 2 days a week, in town. So I was working 7 days a week. And then one day, or actually not one day, many times people would go to Bodhinyana Monastery, as you have done, and say, wow, what a beautiful monastery that is. It's so peaceful. It's so calm. And I would say, what monastery are you talking about? I say, Bodhinyana, where you live. I never see it as peaceful and calm and beautiful. I see it as, those paths need to be swept. You know, that building needs to be finished. The bins need to be taken out for the rubbish collectors to come. That monk needs to sort of, be taught how to meditate and not to talk too much. We need to... That was my workplace. And so because it was my workplace, there's always stuff to be fixed, stuff to be done, people to be taught, monks to be advised, visitors to be counseled. It was my workplace. And of course, I couldn't live in it like you do as visitors. So one day I thought, this is really unfair. I build this place up, look after it, teach it, and other people enjoy it, and I can't. So that's where I started this idea. Whenever I can, Monday mornings, I'm not an abbot. I'm not a teacher. I'm not Ajahn Brahm. I renounce that role. One morning, it's only one morning off a week, that's not much. So what would happen? You'd get up there and say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you've got to tell that monk off, he called me a bad name. I said, who are you talking to? You, Ajahn Brahm, said, no, I'm not abbot today. This is my my morning off. There'll be a phone call. Someone needs to arrange a funeral. Sorry, not me. I'm not at work this morning. Someone would say, oh, just the pipes are leaking and the water's going all over the place. I'm only a visitor. So one morning a week, I'd be a visitor in a monastery in which I lived and supposedly ran. I know, I'd be a visitor. An amazing thing happens. When I stopped being an owner, instead was a visitor. I use those words very clearly. When I was a visitor, I could see that monastery like you see it. I could see all its beauty, peace, the tranquility there, and go in the hall and just go and sit somewhere. No one would ask me a question, say, I'm only a visitor, I don't know where things are. And I could enjoy it. And then I started, obviously, if it works for me, why can't it work for you? So when you go home, I don't know how much money you paid for your home, for your apartment, but it's usually a lot of money, one of the biggest investments in your life. And what do you do when you're there? Just always clean it up, wash it up, arrange it, vacuum it, polish it, paint it. You go out to the garden. If you've got a garden, you've got to mow the lawn, you've got to prune the bushes, you've got to... It's just another work camp for you. How many of you, when you're here, you see there's too much grass. So how many of you mow the lawn? It's not your job, is it? You're here to relax. Even how many of you just clean your toilets up? No, we're paying somebody else to do that after the end of the retreat. It's not your job. So you can just relax and enjoy this place. You're visitors. So when you get home, maybe give one morning a week, or afternoon or something, to being a visitor in the house where you call your home. So what does that mean? There's dishes to be washed from last night's dinner. It's not your job. How many of you, go to a restaurant and you wash the dishes afterwards? That'd be crazy, wouldn't it? So look at your house one day a week, like a restaurant you're visiting. You don't need to wash the dishes. You don't need to even clean the table. You're a visitor. I don't mean for 7 days. If it goes 7 days a week, that'll get a bit much. But at least one morning a week, so you can enjoy the house in which you live. So this is like the insight. Why is it people are so tense and tired? And you take that out on other people. That is one of the main reasons. You see that again and again. The main reason why people get angry at one another. That old insight into resilience. Mentioned at the beginning of this retreat, but it's a great place to mention. Now, why is it that people, sometimes they're just like, the fuse is short, something sparks and they explode. Why is it that little things happen? You stupid computer! Why is it? Why do the police always get me when I'm speeding, not all these other people? This is really unfair. Why is it we get disappointed so easily? It's because our resilience has been lost. We're a string which has been stretched to its limits. And something hits it, another break. Or like a bing, a really loud noise. But if you loosen the tension on the string and something hits it, it never breaks. Boom, you can hear some sort of resonance, low pitch. But when there's no tension on it at all, it's as loose as can be. Of course, then something hits it, doesn't make a sound. You know, your husband calls you fat. You don't say, I'm not fat. Are you calling me fat? That is fat shaming. That's grounds for divorce. I'm going to... You call me fat. Look at you. So whatever happens, you have this beautiful resilience. Okay, yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah, they call you fat, you're wrong. Ajahn Chah used to say, if somebody calls you a dog, look at your bottom. See if you have a tail. If you haven't got a tail, you can't be a dog. End of problem. I'm sorry, sir, you made a mistake. But you don't get angry because you've got the resilience there. But, you're even a little bit tight and somebody says that and you burst out and break. And it's not just the physical and just breaking up with your loved ones and your kids, you get angry at them. Your parents, your friends. Why do we do that? Because we're so tight. If we can just relax more, have resilience. It's amazing afterwards you go home and people call you an idiot and you say, you stupid Buddhist. Yeah. Yeah. That's fine. You've got this wonderful sense of ease that nothing can affect you. And you start to understand it's not just, again, that world outside, it's the world inside as well. Just the disappointments, the stress, which really get into your body and get those cancers going. And get the sort of the heart disease going. As some of the previous caretakers always into many of these little interesting parts of science, And she sent a TED talk to me of this brilliant sort of psychologist, doctor, whatever, who was researching executives and their cardiac health and saying, is it what they eat? Or is it just the stress of their work? What was the main indicator of cardiac disease or cardiac health? And she did a study, and it's all evidence-based. Nothing to do with the food you eat or the stress of your job, but everything to do with the attitude you have to those jobs you have to do. If you have any bit of negativity, why me? I don't need to do this. Why do you have to give it to me? This is really too much. That type of attitude, cardiac disease, cholesterol went up enormously. But people who took their work as a challenge, a happy time, something they could do, yay, I'm teaching a retreat for 9 days. Wow, I can give so much. Thank you so much for giving this opportunity. If you have the positive attitude, it's not stress anymore. It's a challenge, which you willingly, without any sort of negativity, you want to do. And the CEOs like that had great cardiac health. So it was very much to do with how tight you are. And you can all feel that inside of you. Sometimes how it is pulled but so many directions and we're almost sometimes ready to break. Because sometimes you don't know how you could be really relaxed to the max. That is a sign. So this is actually the insights which we can get. You can feel that when your mind is very peaceful. You can feel your body relax. You understand you are a visitor while you're here on this retreat. You don't own Jhana Grove, which means that it feels so much different than if you're meditating at home. Home, you've got responsibilities. Here, you're irresponsible. So irresponsible, you can spend the whole week hugging a teddy bear. Tell your boss at work that that's what you did. And he will refer you to counselling. So this is the insights which we can get. Our mind is peaceful, we can enjoy, and then you find out you get really healthy, very wise, and even when you're not trying to get jhanas, then they just come to you. You stop, and this little nimitta jhana land starts swinging towards you. That's so sweet. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. It's 1 minute past nine, so got some of the questions done, but there's still a lot more. So we'll see what happens this evening. There may not be a possibility to answer every question, but those questions which have merit will get answered. Those people who don't have enough good karma, it's not my fault. I am irresponsible.